I wanted to first start off with a story, my story. When I was a young girl, I took 8 years of speech therapy. Several times a week, I would have to go to a speech pathologist because I could not speak. I also went to summer school every single summer. I also went to Sylvan Learning Center because there's some issues that I had in my learning experience. And I continued to grow in my educational experience, and today, you get to recognize me as the senator from the 14th District, St. Louis County. And with that, I'll start and present Senate Bill 516. When we started out on the mission of dealing with the transfer situation, I really took some time to reflect on what are certain things that have prevented our students from growing and achieving in some high poverty areas. And I decided that I would go along with a motto, and that motto would be to rebuild and to preserve and sustain. Rebuild districts that look like Norm D or Riverview, preserve districts that look like Ferguson Florissant and University City, and sustain districts that look like Rittner or Pattonville or Clayton. I represent all of those school districts in my Senate district. And understanding that I have the entire spectrum of accreditation within my Senate district, I wanted to come up with an approach that was balanced and it was thoughtful, so that every single child, regardless of what zip code they come from, had an opportunity to learn and to achieve. So I wanted to just briefly start off with some of the issues I wanted to clear up in some legislation that we had a couple of years ago dealing with charter schools. The bill that we passed 2 years ago left the state on the hook for paying the closure costs for charter schools. And I wanted to ensure that sponsors were responsible for paying any closure costs, but also that the state didn't have to take money out of their revenue unnecessarily. I will also tell you that in school accreditation, many of the bills that we have heard so far have talked about the idea of accrediting individual schools as opposed to accrediting unaccrediting full districts. And I have a trigger in my language. It actually says at the point a school district becomes, at least 65% of their schools become unaccredited, then the district will become fully accredited. But until that trigger is actually, before we get to that point, we should accredit individual schools. And within that, we give an opportunity to address some of the issues that the Normandy School District and the Riverview School District have faced in the past year. And part of that deals with educational larceny, and I'll get to that in just a little bit. But we also want to classify our charter schools. Right now, that's not happening. And we wanted to ensure if we have charter schools in unaccredited districts, that there is an opportunity for families, for children to know what the classification is of these charter schools. And I think that's just the only right thing to do. But we also wanted to ensure that the districts that have charter schools, that classification is not rated in their overall MSIP standard. Now, I've briefly talked about in the past meetings that we've had that we do not address the special administrative boards at all in our statutes. And as I have spoken, the senator from the 5th, Senator Nasheed, and I have talked about the special administrative boards. There's no out in current law. A special administrative board can exist for 100 years, according to our statutes right now. And the question that arises as we deal with 2015 and MSIP review, MSIP 5, we need to figure out when schools become unaccredited and if they lapse and if there is a special administrative board, how long are we going to allow a special administrative board to be intact? Is it going to be 7 years? Is it going to be 10 years, 20 years? At what point do taxpayers get to make the decision of them deciding how money is spent in their local school districts? So in this legislation, and it's completely negotiable, but we do need to deal with the issue, how long are we going to allow for special administrative boards to exist in a school district? The next portion of my bill deals with the local effort. And as Senator Lovato was talking about earlier, we think about the example of Independence, Missouri, and when it took over a portion of Kansas City. Now, this is really complicated, but I want you guys to pay really clear attention to what I'm about to say. When Kansas City, or when Independence took a portion of Kansas City, the local tax base from Kansas City for that portion that was annexed, every single year, about $10 million leaves Kansas City and goes into Independence, Missouri. It's called the windfall. Every single year. When the legislation initially passed some years ago by former Senator Lovato, the former senator from the 11th, we didn't think about that, about the local input, how much money is coming from the formula to a district, and we never thought about what is offset. So right now, Independence not only gets the windfall of $10 million every single year, but in addition to that, we didn't make an adjustment for how much money comes from the formula. So not only are they getting what they got from the valuation from 2004, they're also getting the state, the same compensation from the state at the same levels, the same amount of money from Kansas City, and there was never an adjustment. So what we're trying to do is to correct that so that more money can stay in the formula and your school districts don't have to pay for that windfall. The next issue is the transient student ratio. I call it the transient student modifier. And this is really critical. I've had several conversations with people in my district. How do we account for students who live in the wrong zip code? Poor students. How do we account for that? We have large numbers of students who are transient, and there's some information, hopefully my staff passed out, that deals with the transient rates of every single school in this school district in the state. In the Normandy School District, our preliminary numbers say 34% transient rate. In the University City School District, the transient rate is about 20%. And in the Jennings School District, the Ferguson-Florissant School District, transient rates are at 20 and 30%. Well, you look at that and you wonder, well, why are these school districts not doing well? And when we look at the calculation of how we accredit students in school districts, what we're trying to do is make a difference, create a difference, and segment out what a traditional residential student is versus what a transient student is. And the first thing that my bill does is define what is a transient student. A transient student who is a person who goes from district to district, from school to school. As I mentioned last week, when Senator Pierce had his bill, there are students who go from district to district 3, 4, 5 times every single school year. And that school district where they end up at is 100% accountable for that student, even though they've been there for 2 days, or for 2 weeks, or for 2 months. And so what we try to do in our calculation, and I'm not going to try to get too specific about that, I know that Don will talk about it a little bit later, but what we try to do is look at the growth model rate for students who are transient versus the growth model for students who are traditional residential students. And for, in terms of MSIP and accreditation, we weigh the outcomes differently. If you've been in the school district for less than 3 years, we weigh those transient students at 30% as it applies to MSIP review. But for traditional residential students, what we do is weigh the growth of the student outcomes at 70%, because those are the numbers that really, really count. And instead of, we hear oftentimes different groups saying that X school district isn't doing well with their outcomes, what we're able to do with this calculation is to look at what the true growth is. And long term, just this data alone will allow future legislatures to figure out what can we do for students that are highly mobile and transient and are in multiple school districts per year. So we look at that, we define what a transient student is. We have the transient student modifier, which would apply to the accreditation of a school building or a school district, and we try to do the best job that we can so that we can equalize the playing field and also come up with policy for the future that benefits people who live in high poverty areas. The next portion of my bill deals with parent notification of unaccredited school districts and schools and home visits. Now, we all agree that when Norm D was provisional for 20 years, that is unacceptable. All of us agree to that. No school district should be provisionally accredited for 20 years. However, there was never any notification by the school district to parents or community leaders about the status of the Norm D school district. So last summer, when I started getting 20 phone calls every single day about Norm D becoming unaccredited and what happened at the Supreme Court, everyone was surprised, but they shouldn't have been surprised, because the scores for the last 20 years were so low. So I say, instead of waiting until you get to the cliff and you fall off, let families know what the status is at the provisional accreditation level, at the unaccredited level, and let parents know what their options are when an individual school or school district becomes unaccredited. I also say in my legislation that we should have home visits. Now, as I sit before you, I'm not only talking to you as a senator, I'm also talking to you as a current school board member and someone who is serving in a district that is struggling. So my approach in this bill is very, very different. And I live in the midst of everything that's going on right now, and some people may call it chaos. But we have adopted a program in our district where we do 2 home visits every single year. We do it in the fall and we do it in the spring. Our district pays for 50% of the costs. The way that I have this written in the bill right now does not look like what we practice in our own district. But what we do in our district is to provide these home visits. We make sure that we pay for taxi rides to the school if necessary, for other visits that we may need. But what we have found is when you have a conversation with Keisha's mom and you tell Keisha's mom that she's not showing up for the first 3 periods of the school day and you're at that house, it makes a heck of a difference. And the parent, Keisha's parent, may at first be, why are you at my house? And that's what happens. We have teachers who volunteer every single week to go to these parents' homes and talk about the status of their children. And what we're dealing with right now are children whose parents are often children themselves. And many people have talked about a wraparound approach, and that's something that we should absolutely have. So in my legislation, I talk about home visits. This specific language can be cleaned up just a little bit more. I do admit to that. But I also wanted to talk about a couple of other things in here. The firewall, student promotion as it's defined in the legislation. So as a school board member, we've been trying to pass something that's called a firewall, and let me tell you what that looks like. We know that math and reading, or English language, are the most essential categories, standards that a student should meet. When I look at percentages from school to school in my school district, I see 30% of students who are at basic or below basic. And then I see 25% of students who are at proficiency. If a student is unable to read, if a student is unable to calculate, to do basic math, they're going to be unable to do any science or social studies. Those are the 2 basic things. So I say, if a student is in 4th grade, or if they're in 7th grade and they're not proficient in math or in English language, we have a sit-down meeting with the administrator, with the teacher, and with the parents. And we say, listen, Keisha is not where she needs to be in terms of math and English. And we're going to have to do something to increase her outcomes. And so what we have been talking about as a school board is putting in some resources for these families, for these individuals, such as after-school training and tutoring, Saturday school. We have implemented a Saturday class for just the ACTs in our school district. And we are literally trying to increase the outcomes on ACT scores. But we've done that as a school district, and I'm dealing with the same kids in my district as I represent in my full school district. But we say to Keisha's mom, listen, we're going to do everything possible that we can do in fourth grade, and we're going to let Keisha go on. We're going to do summer school, we're going to do after school, before school, Saturday class if we have to, and we're going to allow for Keisha to go on to sixth grade, or we're going to allow her to go to fifth grade. But if Keisha is not proficient by the end of fifth grade, or not proficient at the end of eighth grade, Keisha doesn't go to sixth grade. If Keisha is in eighth grade, Keisha doesn't go to ninth grade. We have to stop allowing these students to move forward when they do not have the basic skills. The basic skills are start with math and English language. That's where it starts. If they're unable to be at a proficient level at that point, then we need to move on and give them the resources that they need. And yes, this is a long bill, but I'm going to try to go through all of it. Also, at the point under unaccredited districts and schools, when there is a district with 65% of their schools that are unaccredited, we offer free tutoring. So in order to fund this, and I don't sit on appropriations, but I'm hoping you guys appreciate this idea enough that you would help me out, we create the Unaccredited School District Improvement Fund. I will tell you that I talk to business professionals every single week. I talk to people like Maxine Clark, who runs the KIPP School, and she says, Maria, I wish that people in my community, in my business community, would give more money to schools to help them in their needs outside of just St. Louis City, but also, you know, within St. Louis County. Well, we have an obligation to provide the needs that our kids need, but if we want to specifically direct private funds to a mission that is absolutely credible, which is to get students to a place where they can be fully proficient in every single area, I wanted to create a fund where not only the business sector, but if the legislature so chooses, because we don't have to choose, but if the legislature so chooses, we can add funds to this unaccredited school district improvement fund so that these children across the board can receive free tutoring. In this section as well, I add language about No Child Left Behind. So let me tell you a really quick story, since we only have 5 minutes anyway, but let me tell you a really quick story. Only because I'm on the school board did I know more about No Child Left Behind. When I first ran for office, all the advocates that supported me always said, well, No Child Left Behind is an unfunded mandate, and that's essentially all I knew and all I spoke about, but for the experience of being on the school board. We had an individual school, there are 28 languages that are spoken in this individual school, that was at a level 4 according to No Child Left Behind. And we had to make some changes. So we looked at what you could do within No Child Left Behind. And No Child Left Behind gives you multiple options of what you can do. You can change the teacher population, the student population, administrators. You can hire third-party entities. And then I found out when we sought the waiver, our state sought the waiver for Common Core, that this section of No Child Left Behind was taken out. So what I do is add the language back into No Child Left Behind that allows an individual school or a school district to have these options of what to do at the point their school or school district becomes unaccredited. Also, what's important in here, and it's very new, and something that I haven't previously supported, but I am in this situation. At the point a district becomes, a full district becomes unaccredited, the certain employers or employees can be terminated. And that's a big deal. It's something that I've never supported before, but I'm looking at what's happening in our district and I'm seeing the politics every single day, where there are people who are not terminated that should have been terminated a long time ago. So here's how it works. What I wanted to do in terms of options for students starts this way. If there is a district, if we are accrediting and unaccrediting individual schools, what I want to happen is for a student who's in an unaccredited school to have the first choice of going to a school within that district that is fully accredited. Of course, it's based on the class size. And so that would be their first option, because what we're finding is that these children are staying at home. They're going back to their districts. In one of the handouts that I gave you, in this second wind of open enrollment and transfers, there are only 172 students that have even chosen to transfer. That's it. So my philosophy is, if these children are deciding on their own and their families are deciding on their own to stay within the boundaries of an unaccredited district, then we need to give them options in that district. Again, this is something that I have never supported. Private options, public money, going to private institutions within the boundaries of an unaccredited school. I've never supported that, but for this case, these children are going back to their communities. And I say, if they're going back to their communities and we're trying to maintain the philosophy of rebuilding and preserving and sustaining, then we have to give them an ability to grow, but everyone has the ability to grow. So I say the first option is, let's try to find classrooms within the district that are fully accredited, that have enough room, and allow these kids to transfer. But at that point, if they cannot transfer into a school that has class room in their classrooms, then they have two other options. One is the current option that we have right now, which is to transfer. I am a transfer student. I went to the Clayton School District, and I am very proud of being a transfer student. My mother sacrificed so that I could be called a senator and speak before you today. If there are parents who choose to transfer, and they're fewer and fewer every day, they should have that opportunity. But I also think if there are parents who want the option, even if it's just for a moment, if they want the option to use the local levy to go to a private non-sectarian school, they should have that option as well. And I don't say that it works. I'm not saying that a charter school works. But I'm saying if these children are staying within the parameters of the school district that's unaccredited, give them some options. And also at the same time, let's reduce the amount of money that's leaving the district. So a portion of my bill, and I'm going completely off script at this point, but a portion of my bill deals with indebtedness. So part of the tuition rate right now is part of the tuition. So I say in my legislation, any bonded indebtedness should not be included in the tuition of a transfer student. Frances Howland, my 21-page fiscal note, says that it would cost $465,000. It's not Frances Howell's money. It's Normandy's money. Let me say that again so it can be clear. In the fiscal note, Frances Howell says if we took away the bonded indebtedness out of the tuition rate, it would cost $465,000. Not Frances Howell's money. It would be Normandy's money. And so we have to, and again, I don't have the silver bullet. I don't think any of us have the silver bullet, but I do believe that all of us can roll up our sleeves and figure out what can we do to stay loyal to the philosophy of rebuilding a school district that has multiple needs, preserving school districts that have needs as well, and sustaining school districts that are fully accredited. So also in my bill, I say that every single school, and this is the low-hanging fruit that I talk about all the time, we all agree that school districts should have the determination to say what a good class size looks like. And we all believe in that. But what I do for receiving school districts in my legislation is I phase out over time. So instead of some of these districts who are just a little bit upset about receiving, you know, only 200 students and they have the means, I say, let's do what we did in the VIC program. And every year after 100% of full transfers, in my legislation it says 2 years of 100% full transfers, but that, again, that's negotiable. Every year we would eliminate a grade level. So the first year, kindergartners wouldn't be able to transfer. And then the next year, first graders wouldn't be able to. And then the next year, second graders. And so those receiving school district, they would know that there is an end date in terms of receiving transfer students. They would know, they would be confident in knowing that, okay, we don't have to make adjustments for this, we don't have to add more teachers, et cetera. So I add the phase out language, which is really important. The other thing I do is add a lot of the language for the VIC program, the desegregation program that existed for folks who lived in St. Louis City. It is a program that worked. If it is a 30-year program that worked and there were coordinating authorities that were able to transfer students across St. Louis County, then why don't we look at that model again and adopt it? So I add that language in here. I also have three transfer authorities. It is not my position for Jefferson City to decide what happens in St. Louis when it comes to transfers. Just like I don't want Jefferson City to have to make the decision of who transfers where in Kansas City if they so decide to do transfers at all. It is not up to Jefferson City to do that, but there should be local authorities that deal with the transfer program. The other thing that I add that's very important for high poverty areas is that we have what we call doubling and tripling. Now, y'all may not know what doubling and tripling is, but let me just explain to you what it looks like in my district. Because we have so much poverty, there are multiple families that are living in one household. So if a student under the VIC program, if you had a sibling that was in, obviously in the same household, they would get priority in transferring to the same school. I expand that to say if you have another relative in the second or third degree, same age, same whatever, they can also have priority in transferring with their relative. So I expand that to make sure that family can stay together. And we know how important that is. The next portion of my bill, just to reiterate, is the local private transfer option. And I want it to be a little bit more specific on this. When an unaccredited school, or when a school becomes unaccredited, or a district becomes unaccredited, it's very important that the community know that that's one of their options, to take the part of the local levy and take that amount of money and go to a private school. You know, a lot of people have different ideas about this. Again, that's something that I have never supported in the past, but for this situation. And our constitution, our state constitution, completely stays silent on local dollars going to private entities. It's not state money going to private entities, it's local money going to private entities. I also add language dealing with school administrators, the model evaluation instrument. Our teachers have consistently talked about them having, if they're going to have an evaluation tool, then administrators should as well. This is something that I truly believe in, especially as a school board member who has seen the performance of different administrators. Not all are bad, but some are definitely questionable. And I just say we should have a model evaluation instrument. So teacher evaluations in unaccredited and provisionally accredited schools. There are a couple of things that ideas that I had. We oftentimes deal with professional development and we deal with contracting in our executive session. And I've heard at the very beginning of my experience in the legislature that teachers just are very interested in professional development. And then I went to the school board And then I realized that there are some teachers who want to minimize the number of days they do for professional development. So I say if you're in an unaccredited school district, you have to do a minimum of 11 days of professional development. Now, this is a completely arbitrary number, and I'm going to tell you it's completely arbitrary, and it's negotiable. But the fact remains, we have to do something to build up the skill sets for teachers. Part of the, going backwards for a second, part of the evaluation, all of that language is written by the MNEA. What teachers care about is making sure that when they are reviewed, there is a third party that is available. I knew that I was going to be working against groups and for groups, and I knew that no one was going to be 100% happy in my approach. And I think if we truly, truly care about moving forward, then we have to ensure that every single entity gets something that they really need. And what teachers look for is fairness in evaluations. The other thing is structured collaboration. This came from my 10th grade geometry teacher at Clayton. And we were hanging out one night, Mr. K, and he says, you know what I would like to do is a teacher swap. You know, Maria, I'm a math teacher. I've been working in this district for 22 years, and I would like to go into Norm-D or into Riverview for 2 weeks and switch with a teacher who's at the same set of curricula in math class and just do an exchange, a structured collaboration. See what it's like to teach children who are in a district with not a lot of resources versus what it looks like in a school where there are a lot of resources. And if you're able to have that relationship across cultural boundaries, then I think it would help improve the sensitivity and the skill sets for teachers across the board. Parent portals, this is something that I'm really interested in. So this idea actually came from the deputy superintendent of St. Louis City who serves on the University City School Board. And he said, you know, Maria, the parent portal, now the parent portal is something that does anything from looking at how much money is in their lunch account to getting grades to looking at teacher responses to best practices. It has a huge scope. But what he said to me, Maria, you know, because all of these parents, many of these parents are so mobile, wouldn't it be nice to have a mobile app so that we can just look up, you know, how is Keisha doing in a classroom? These parents that I represent don't have internet at home. They don't have internet, but you know what they do have? They have a smartphone. And just how we look on our apps and our phones, wouldn't it be nice if we had the parent portal where parents can look at exactly the status of their students? And for our parents who do have internet at home, they look at this parent portal and they see it as a useful tool, and they try to work with their children as much as possible so that they can increase the overall outcomes for their students or get on their students for you know, talking back in class or something like that. Then the length of school day and hours of instruction. Again, this is low-hanging fruit. This is a concept that is in Senator Schmidt's bill et al., as well as others. But the difference between my legislation and the other is that mine is fiscally responsible. So, and I say that because we provide caps. The amount of money that it would cost just across the board, especially if you're a formula district, is quite large. So what I wanted to do is to focus on schools that are unaccredited but have a free and reduced lunch percentage at 75%. And the children would have had to qualify for this within the last 3 years. So there are probably a couple of things that I've forgotten in this bill. It's very technical, but it's thought out. And again, I was trying to do something that was balanced for everyone.